What do Dick Cheney and Rahm Emanuel have in common? Aside from polarizing personalities, both served as chief of staff to the President of the United States, as did Donald Rumsfeld, Leon Panetta, and a relative handful of others. The chiefs of staff, often referred to as the gatekeepers, wield tremendous power in Washington and beyond. They decide who is allowed to see the president, negotiate with Congress to push the president's agenda, and most crucially, enjoy unparalleled access to the leader of the free world. Through extensive intimate interviews with all 17 living chiefs and two former presidents, journalist and producer Chris Whipple pulls back the curtain on this unique fraternity in his new book, The Gatekeepers: How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. The book is published by Crown, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Chris Whipple to the roundtable this morning. Chris, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
What brought you to want to focus in on the job of chief of staff?
You know, it was a phone call out of the blue from a filmmaker named Jules Naudet, who with his brother had done 9/11 for CBS, and they wanted to know if I would partner with them on a documentary, which we did in 2013 for the Discovery Channel. But I realized that it barely scratched the surface of this incredible untold story of 17 living White House chiefs who have been not only the president's closest confidant, but also the person they depend on to execute their agenda. I mean, Jim Baker, the gold standard, put it best when he said, you can make the argument that he's the second most powerful person in government.
So when you look at what defines a chief of staff, give us a little bit about the history of the position and how it has transformed over the decades.
You know, there's nothing in the Constitution about a White House chief. He's unelected and unconfirmed and didn't really exist until Dwight Eisenhower appointed Sherman Adams, who was a famously gruff gatekeeper. They called him the abominable no man. But I really trace the modern White House chief to H.R. Haldeman, Nixon's infamous chief, who was blamed for the biggest scandal in American history, Watergate. But the irony is that Haldeman really, you know, all of his successors will tell you that he created the template for the modern empowered chief, who is not only the confidant, but also the guy who executes the president's agenda. He controls the information flow, and he's the honest broker. And above all, perhaps, he's the guy who tells the president what he doesn't want to hear if he knows what he's doing.
One of the things that you write about in the book, which I find so fascinating, and obviously a lot of this depends on the individuals that we're talking about, but it's the relationship, right? I mean, it gets down to the relationship between these two human beings.
It's critical. And, you know, there's a great story in the book when Barack Obama was about to win the presidency. He very quietly organized a meeting with his closest aides, you know, most of them from Chicago, and all of, not all, but most of Bill Clinton's former White House chiefs. And the point of the meeting was to decide who should be his chief, and Erskine Bowles immediately spoke up. This was Clinton's third White House chief. And Bowles said, leave your Chicago friends at home. Now, what he meant by that, of course, Obama wound up ignoring that and picking Rahm Emanuel, but what he meant by that is that it can be a real problem when you have a good friend, a close friend as White House chief. He has difficulty telling the president what he doesn't want to hear. You have to be clear that you report to the president, but you also need a guy, in my mind, the two best in modern history were Jim Baker and Leon Panetta, somebody who's really confident and independent enough to tell the president when he's wrong.
I want to get to Baker and Panetta in a moment. I do want to go back, though, to Jimmy Carter. You write in the book about how he tried to govern without a chief of staff and the really profound impact that had on his presidency.
Yeah, so think about Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. Jimmy Carter was arguably the most intelligent president of the 20th century. Ronald Reagan was famously called unfairly, I think, an amiable dunce. But Reagan intuited something that Carter never understood, which is an outsider president really needs an insider to make things work. Carter, I mean, and of course, Reagan chose Jim Baker, the consummate chief. Carter thought he could run the White House by himself, and it was just chaos. He was unable to prioritize. His closest aide was Ham Jordan, who wound up as a kind of de facto chief of staff, but he never even wanted the job and was totally unsuited for it, disorganized. 2.5 years in, Carter finally made Jordan his chief of staff, and ultimately Jack Watson got the job in the last year of the Carter administration, and Watson did a terrific job, but it was too late to save the Carter presidency.
Which really goes to show how important the role is.
It's absolutely critical. I mean, I think, you know, having talked to all 17 living chiefs, a lot of their staffers, secretaries of state, others who worked with them, I think that from Watergate to Iran-Contra to the Iraq War to the rollout of Obamacare to the botched executive orders on immigration, you know, the White House chief can make the difference between success and disaster.
You tell a fascinating story in the book about the Ford administration and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, who were very ambitious, who come together to work within the Ford administration, and not only what they did for President Ford, which was not win the White House for a full term, however, their power could be seen years down the line.
This is one of the great stories. I mean, Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. Cheney was a down-and-out ne'er-do-well, if I can use that old expression. He'd been thrown out of college twice. He had a drinking problem. He woke up face down in a jail cell one day and decided that he was going to change some things. He wound up getting a political science degree. Rumsfeld takes him under his wing in the Nixon White House and then makes him his deputy under Jerry Ford after Nixon's resignation. Well, Rumsfeld really whipped the Ford White House into shape. You know, he made the trains run on time. And then Cheney took over as a 34-year-old White House chief of staff, and he absolutely was, believe it or not, the most popular guy in Washington. He was self-effacing, had a terrific sense of humor. The press corps loved him. Ever since, White House chiefs have been saying to themselves, what happened to that guy? Well, what happened was, as we all know, he became Bush 43's very powerful and influential white vice president. And really, I think, you know, he wound up usurping some of the traditional powers of the White House chief. I think Andy Card had mission impossible trying to operate with Cheney and Rumsfeld at that point, who were absolute masters of the bureaucracy and really ran circles around it.
So let us go now to James Baker and Leon Panetta, who you hold up as really somewhat the gold standards in this job. Let's start with James Baker and how he redefined the position and ultimately came to master it, in your opinion.
Yeah, and you know, Ronald Reagan had the courage to pick Baker, which was a brave choice because Baker had run the campaigns of his opponents, George H.W. Bush, and prior to that, Jerry Ford. But Baker was the consummate White House chief because he not only did he know how Washington worked and he knew Capitol Hill and how to count votes and figure out what was doable for Reagan, but he also figured out, and this may sound familiar, he also figured out how to survive the slings and arrows of you know, the internecine warfare within the White House. You know, he had the so-called true believers, the hardcore Reagan ideologues coming after him tooth and nail. But he was savvy enough to befriend Nancy Reagan, who was very powerful as the so-called personnel director, and Michael Deaver, who's a deputy chief who was practically family. And so he was able to really outmaneuver the right-wingers in the Reagan White House and really was able to, I mean, I think that there would have been no Reagan revolution without James Baker.
So how much are they architects of an administration? Are they still taking the lead from the boss, or are they in many ways coming up with the plans and handing it to them?
I think the answer is both. I think that there's no question that Don Reagan made the mistake of thinking, as one person put it, that he was the CEO and Reagan was the retired chairman of the board. The president is in charge. But to give you an example that has, I think, some resonance today, Ronald Reagan was hell-bent on going to Capitol Hill and reforming Social Security as his first major initiative. Baker knew that that was the so-called third rail of American politics. You touch it, you get electrocuted. He told Reagan that. He was able to change Reagan's mind. He changed course, went for tax cuts, and the rest is history. It's hard to imagine. Now let's fast forward to Donald Trump. It's really hard to imagine a Jim Baker, a Leon Panetta, allowing a president to do repeal and replace Obamacare when it was obviously a loser from the get-go. The votes weren't there, and it would have come back to bite them even if it passed it.
I want to get to more about the current administration in a moment. Chris Whipple is our guest. The name of the book is The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. Leon Panetta, of course, during the Bill Clinton administration, what was unique about their relationship?
Well, I think that Panetta and Baker have something in common. These were guys who'd been around the block. Panetta had been a congressman. He'd been OMB director. He was grounded. He was confident, had nothing to prove. He was able to go in and close the door and tell Bill Clinton what he didn't want to hear. And boy, did Clinton need that. A year and a half into his presidency, Bill Clinton was pretty much dead in the water on his major agenda. He couldn't get traction. His chief of staff to that point had been a very able guy, an old friend named Mac McClarty, but he just wasn't empowered by Clinton, and he couldn't discipline him. So Panetta finally came in after an intervention, basically, by the First Lady and others, Al Gore and others. Panetta came in with his deputy Erskine Bowles and absolutely whipped that White House into shape, turned it around, ran it very efficiently. And I think that without Leon Panetta, Bill Clinton might have been a one-term president.
One of the things that I found interesting in the reading of the book is you talk about the successes of both Panetta and Baker. They both had very good relationships with the First Ladies. They both had, in Baker's case, as you said, a very strong relationship with Nancy Reagan, and Panetta with Hillary Rodham Clinton.
That's absolutely true. And, one of Panetta's successors, John Podesta, also formed a very close bond with the First Lady. Podesta was very successful in steering Clinton through the Monica Lewinsky scandal. It's critical. The First Lady is absolutely, someone you have to pay attention to if you're a White House chief. And, of course, the classic cautionary tale is Donald Reagan, who succeeded James Baker, who was arrogant and entitled, and as Nancy put it, he loved the chief part of the title, but not the staff part. Anyway, at one point he hung up the phone on Nancy Reagan after an argument, and Baker said, "That's not just a hiring offense, that may be a hanging offense." And sure enough, Reagan was gone a week later.
During the Obama administration, we heard a lot about the very strong personality of Rahm Emanuel. There were times where it worked very well for the administration, and yet when we see his post-administration performance as the mayor of Chicago, a lot of these questions have resurfaced. What does it tell us about an individual and how they can go on in a position of power with that experience under their belt?
I'm not sure what Rahm's experience as mayor of Chicago tells us about his record as chief of staff? I don't know. That's a hard question. But I can tell you that Rahm is a, first of all, he's obviously a fascinating character. And I try to humanize all 17 of these White House chiefs. This is not just a book about policy or about bureaucracy. It's really about, I tried to put flesh on these guys. Rahm was actually, when he was senior advisor to Clinton, Erskine Bowles, who was then chief of staff, told me that Clinton tried to fire him not once, twice, three or four times, but five times. And because he'd annoyed someone or angered someone on Capitol Hill, and Bowles told Clinton, no, I'm not going to fire him. You know why? Because every time you come out of the Oval Office and you've got a mission impossible, we give it to Rahm, and he comes back in 2 days, and it's done. Rahm takes the hill. There are always bodies left in his wake, but he takes the hill.
Okay, so let's look at where we are now, because one of the things that you talk about in the book, and as we've been discussing throughout our conversation, is that there has been a structure to this job. And so it seems now, with Reince Priebus as Donald Trump's chief of staff, with the Steve Bannon connection as well, the kind of all bets are off, right? I mean, we're not seeing anything in a traditional sense of what a White House, obviously we're not even in, we're 100 days in. So obviously that plays a role. But that you look at where we are with these individuals, and it's hard to draw many comparisons, isn't it?
Well, no, I would say there are comparisons that can be drawn. I mean, this White House takes dysfunction to a whole new level. I mean, this is the most dysfunctional White House in modern history, and you know, the ineptitude is really unprecedented, I think. I mean, no competent White House chief would allow an executive order on immigration, for example, to go out without being vetted by the agencies that are in charge of it. It's been one rookie mistake after another, but the fundamental problem lies with the president. And the problem there is that, you know, every president, every modern president learns, often the hard way, that you cannot govern effectively without empowering a White House chief as first among equals in the White House so that he can execute your agenda. That's a lesson that Trump seems oblivious to, but he's not the first to have to learn this lesson. It took Bill Clinton a year and a half to figure it out. It took Jimmy Carter 2.5 years. Clearly Trump has not figured it out, and his White House is, you know, the most dysfunctional ever, I would say.
Realizing we're not talking about the chief of staff, but a few days ago when President Trump was talking about Steve Bannon and said that was downplaying his role, and he said, you know, I am my own strategist. So we can only assume that he also believes that he is his own chief of staff as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, if you oppose everything Donald Trump stands for, then this is the White House staff for you. This is the organization and structure you want him to keep. I mean, if Donald Trump wants to be Jimmy Carter, if he wants to have one term or worse, he should continue to do exactly what he's doing. It may work when you're running a Manhattan real estate firm. It does not work in the White House. And the lessons of modern political history and the chiefs of staff are just clear.
So I brought up the first ladies a moment ago, and knowing that I would get to this question, which is those family bonds. Now, obviously, the first lady seems to be playing a much smaller role in this administration. However, the children, especially his daughter Ivanka and his son-in-law Jared Kushner, are playing a huge role. How does that play into it and diminish the role of a Reince Priebus?
It doesn't have to diminish his role. And, you know, Baker was the master at dealing with a situation like this. You know, when he faced very similar pressures, and God knows that was a rough White House with all kinds of internecine warfare. Baker called it a rat blank. But he was able to prevail because he shared Ronald Reagan's pragmatism. And I think there's it's clear that Trump is a pragmatist. He's not an ideologue. And he was able to make alliances with Nancy Reagan and with Michael Deaver. So I wrote a piece for Vanity Fair back in December when Priebus was appointed, and I made this comparison and suggested that maybe Priebus would be wise to pay attention to Jared Kushner and try to ally with him and with Ivanka in order to deal with the Bannon of that administration. I haven't seen any evidence that that Priebus is a Jim Baker.
And yet, they're just this idea of Bannon's role, seemingly at this moment anyway, being somewhat reduced. Would that indicate that what you had called for in December is happening in some sense?
I don't know. That's, you know, boy, those are tea leaves that are hard to read. It's hard to know whether that's the case. But what's clear so far is that that nobody seems to be in charge. And if that doesn't change, then Trump may very well be a one-term president. I think the lessons are clear.
Okay, so I have this question, and it'll be my final question, and I don't mean it to be flip, but it will probably come off that way, but I don't mean it to be flip. But I ask this a lot when I'm thinking about those who run for this office of President of the United States, of why would anyone in the name of God want to be President of the United States? And I guess I ask the same question when it comes to Chief of Staff. What is there that makes this a position that somebody would want?
Well, you know, almost every chief of staff, when he gets the job, and so far they've all been men, usually the first phone call is to Jim Baker for reasons we've discussed. And Baker almost always says the same thing, which is, congratulations, you've got the worst blanking job in Washington. But don't forget that it is also, according to Baker, the second most powerful job in government. And, you know, if you talk to these guys, one of the things that really struck me in getting to know all 17 living ex-chiefs is that, you know, no matter what their ideologies may be, I mean, and we're talking about a wide range from Cheney to Podesta, these guys fundamentally, you know, as they showed when they all came together to give Rahm Emanuel, of all people, advice back in, you know, December of 2008, you know, they're patriots, whatever you may think of their politics. And I think that, as Jack Watson, Jimmy Carter's last chief, put it, you know, you're sitting next to the most powerful man in the world. That is heady stuff. And you have a chance to really affect the world. And I think not one of them regrets having taken the job, even though it may have shortened their lifespans.
Chris Whipple is the author of the new book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. The book is published by Crown. Chris, thank you very much for joining us and sharing with us this morning. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The Gatekeepers by Chris Whipple. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.